You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome Colin Fisher back to the podcast. Colin is Associate Professor of Organizations and Innovation at University College London's School of Management. But in his former life, he was a professional jazz trumpet player. He has a fantastic new book. It's called The Collective Edge, Unlocking the Secret Power of Groups. You're going to enjoy this pod. Colin Fisher, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It's so great to be back.
The provocation that you begin your book with is a claim that the real villain in the Harry Potter books isn't Voldemort or Snape or J.K. Rowling. You say, just add that in there. You say it's the Sorting Hat. Why is the Sorting Hat bad?
So it's so funny. When I first read the Harry Potter, I swear, I really thought the Sorting Hat was going to turn out to be a villain. Like, as soon as it was introduced, I'm like, okay. Oh, this thing's sinister. And it took me a long time to kind of put my finger on why that was. But it really is because, you know, it's putting something on your head and saying, this is the category you belong to. You're a Gryffindor. You're a Slytherin. You're a Ravenclaw. And you're a Hufflepuff. I'm sorry, I shouldn't leave that out. But then nobody ever changes, right? Mm-hmm. You're stuck in that box for the whole time you're there. And that, you know, it's so obvious that this is a huge factor in motivating all the conflict that's in that book and in all of those books. So there's all these wars that are essentially wars between these same categories that the Sorting Hat is putting people into when they're 11 years old. And to me, that does seem a little bit sinister. Now, I mean, later in the intro, I do back off that it's not the villain, but it's evoking something that can be a really villainous part of our own brains and our own psychology. And that is that tendency to put people into these categories and then think, that's all I need to know about them. That's the whole of their being to decide, are they going to be a friend of mine or are they going to be my enemy?
So this is something I think you probably learned in both your lives as a jazz musician and as a scientist, is like, we're bad at groups. Like we're not taught to work well in groups. Maybe if we were, again, part of a jazz ensemble or part of a sports team, we had that context, but no one was then saying, oh, by the way, you can take this and make this apply to the rest of your life. It's kind of like it's sink or swim for the rest of us in terms of how to group.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that keeps me in business, right? That we're not really taught how to group. But it's funny that we're such social animals. We spend so much of our life in groups, and yet we're not sort of naturally adept at some really crucial parts of being in these groups. And I mean, I think that really dates back to when you think why evolutionarily we were predisposed to be in groups. It was largely for survival, right? That we want to be in these, that we don't have, you know, claws. We don't have, you know, great defensive armor on the outside of us. And that we're basically kept safe by our ability to distribute labor, that, you know, somebody could keep watch at night, that we can, you know, go sort of hunt and gather in ways that capitalize on differences among us. And yet, when it comes to being in work groups, you know, so if we go back to that kind of hunter-gatherer idea, if you're a prehistoric hunter-gatherer, the worst thing that can happen to you is you get kicked out of your tribe.
Yeah.
Right. That's an existential threat. Mm-hmm. That, oh my God, I'm out in the cold and I have to face these, you know, saber-toothed tigers. And actually there were, you know, predatory kangaroos and eagles were even a threat to early humans. So there are a lot of things where if you're out on your own, you were really in trouble. And so we're a lot of our group-based programming is just trying to keep us in the tribe, that we're sort of going along to get along, even when we maybe don't totally agree with the rest of the group. And that those tendencies, you know, they help us collaborate sometimes, but they're also really a threat when we're doing these really complicated problems that, you know, our brains didn't evolve essentially to do math or to, you know, solve poverty or to conceptualize what it means to help people in the future who don't yet exist, or to help people on the other side of the world, or to at least not harm them with what we're doing. So these sort of tendencies towards tribal thinking and conformity and intergroup conflict end up really working against us in a lot of conventional work settings now.
So the other thing that we have working against us, which is like writ large these days, is this obsession with individualism. And I can actually, young Kelly was all about individualism. You know, I wanted people's right to look and sound different and be different. And this was at a time, you know, I was born in the 60s and so where people didn't have equal rights and where like, and people were, you know, all about conformity or felt like that was going on. But obviously there was, you know, a cultural backlash to that. But now we're at this place where people are so obsessive about it to the point that they don't understand that we don't do this alone, that we can't do this alone, that someone paved the roads and, you know, it's like, we are completely dependent on other people. We are not individual beings in this world. And when you think that way, that also is, to me, an existential threat as well to any sort of group harmony.
Yeah, absolutely. That our, you know, the way we're trying to fix almost everything, right? Like if you look in the self-help aisle or the leadership aisle of the bookstore, you're going to see a lot of stories of great individuals. You're going to get a lot of advice on, you know, sort of improving the island of you. And it's not that any of that's wrong, right? Like there's so many people I respect who are, you know, telling us great things about how to improve ourselves and not, and, you know, it's a lot of advice I take myself. But that if that's the only thing we do, we're not going to accomplish great things, because the evidence is most of the great stuff in the world is getting done by groups. Mm-hmm. That the thorny problems, the most creative things, the most innovative things, those are more and more coming out of groups, in part because the world's just getting more complicated, that it's harder to solve a lot of these problems. And we need diverse expertise. We need a lot more brains and labor engaged in solving these problems. So individualism is a threat when we think, oh, the way we're going to solve these problems is by finding the next hero, or the reason that our, you know, our organization or our team is failing is because we've got this one bad apple. And that leads us to overlook these factors that have to do with group dynamics and a lot of what has to do with the structure and the kind of bones of the group that are many times determining outcomes much more strongly than the characteristics of the individuals who compose them.
All right, let's talk a little bit about how this works out. So one of my mentors at Second City, Sheldon Patinkin, used to say emphatically, playing the games, and by that he meant the games of Iolaus Bone, playing the games makes you an ensemble. So this was a thing that he used to say over and over again, and to the point that it sounds maybe simplistic, but it's not, it's borne out to be true for me, and you have some science to back this up in terms of the chicken and egg of that.
Yeah, absolutely. That, I mean, I think there's kind of two different things I want to pick up on that chicken and egg idea little bit. So that there's a misconception, you know, when I'm in the line of work where I teach people about teams and team leadership all the time, and that a lot of people associate that with team building.
Yep.
and these team building exercises. And there's a lot of great team building exercises out there that have a lot of great content. But there are some that make this assumption that in order for us to work together, we first have to develop a certain kind of trust. And that trust is what I'd normally call like interpersonal or relational trust. That's what a lot of researchers call it. And that's the trust where I'm going to trust you with my deepest, darkest secrets, right? That like I you know, have these kind of relational trust that you have my best interests at heart. And that's, of course, a good thing for a group to have. But this is where the chicken and egg thing comes in. The kind of trust that we use most at work is the trust that you're going to deliver what you say you're going to deliver and of a certain quality at a certain time. And that kind of trust doesn't get developed by things like trust falls. That I don't now trust that you're going to do your work well by the deadline that I'm depending on because we did the trust fall. And so the problem then is the way we get that kind of trust is by working together. That just getting into the game, sort of as it sounds like your mentor would have said, that we start, and that by starting and actually collaborating successfully, then we develop the kind of trust we really need when we're going to be a team. And so the advice to do all this stuff that's completely divorced from the task, that's completely divorced from what we're going to actually need to do together, that kind of advice really misleads a lot of people when they're trying to put their teams together.
Yeah, I think people might assume we do trust falls. We don't. We're about practicing things like listening to each other in low stakes environments so you can use the skill you're going to need when you work with the group. And because it's also embodied and it's play, it touches on those things. It's just interesting. The other thing you talk about sort of emphatically is how structure trumps almost everything. This I found fascinating because the thing I know at Second City, 65 years, we have a process for how we create our shows. We've been doing it the same way. It works. People learn the process. It's a defined period of time. There's sort of rules about what happens in each phase. You're doing iteration in front of audiences, all that. And it always works. At worst, we have a funny show. At best, it's also art, you know, that, and that's great. And forever, I've sort of been like, man, what we have to find a way is to take that process and apply it to every other aspect of our organization, because we get caught up as much suddenly when we're working on a group project that's not about putting up a show, and we make all these mistakes that we're not working inside a structure. And I'm going to get to leadership because I think that's towards the end of the book, but I think it's fascinating. I want to really dig into it, but talk to a bit of us, because also the thing is you're making it less magic. which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find the same thing, you know, coming at this from a background as a jazz musician, you know, the structure and the norms of being in these kind of, you know, artistic contexts where there is a lot of structure that's given to us, right? Like when we're playing music, when we're making a show, there's something already intrinsically interesting and motivating about those tasks, that those are some of the most well-designed tasks known to man. And that a lot of the lessons we get about teamwork and leadership come from sports, they come from the arts, they come from music. But those settings have this huge advantage that they have really motivating work, and it's really well-structured work where we have, you know, in jazz, we have roles that are instruments dictate our roles, and that we're trained and socialized in such a way that we really know what those are, so that when we come together to improvise, you know, we know those roles need to get fulfilled, and we know, you know, who's supposed to at least take the lead on fulfilling them. And the same is true in sports. The same, I'm sure, is true in comedy improvising, and that these kinds of things where we know what our role is, there are norms for how we interact within these groups, the tasks themselves are really motivating, well-designed tasks. We don't have those when we're doing a project in the middle of a bureaucratic organization, right? Like we no longer have any of those characteristics. And so what we need to do then is exactly as you're saying, give the same kind of structure to figure out what is it about those tasks that's so great? How do I create that in my organization? What is it about the way in which we have norms for interacting or the kinds of roles that we've created in these other settings, and how can I take those into my organization? And that's really the main work of building a team.
I was really fascinated by Chapter 8, which is called The Idea Meritocracy. And you talk a bit about Ray Dalio and Bridgewater, which I don't necessarily want to get much into. I'm not a fan. He's made a bunch of money. There might be other reasons why. Anyway, you have this idea around bursty communication, mm-hmm. and you also talk about, you know, deviating from social norms. And this was really interesting to me because, you know, you do want to. You know, the thing with Dalio that I think a lot of people get attracted to is this idea of like honest communication, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. In some cases, if I would say not so much if it's hurting people, mm-hmm. or maybe you only have one. You know, how honest can you be in terms of what your knowledge is about in any given moment, mm-hmm. why something happened or turned out? But you talk about this idea of idiosyncrasy credits, which allow an individual to deviate within a group. This comes from Edwin Hollander. Talk a bit about that, because he, you know, you set up that you need all these norms, you need a specific structure, you know, for groups to work well, but I think you also need this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's funny, choosing Dalio for that example, in a way, it's just like I'm attracted to understand these really extreme cases, right? Like the, right. And certainly Bridgewater was the most extreme of taking seriously this idea of we are going to have the most transparent communication that we possibly can. Now, I also make the point that that is clearly not for everybody, and it may not even be for most people, but the impetus behind it to say, how can we make our communication more transparent? How can we make sure that we are sharing what we know? That's such a fundamental problem in most groups, that it's not that we don't get the right expertise in the room. It's that we have the expertise and the information in the room, and then we don't share it. That like it's sitting right there around the table, and we need to be able to get that out there. And, you know, the key, I'm sure I don't have to tell you and your listeners to this, is what we call psychological safety, that you need to have this culture where you feel it's okay to speak up, that it's okay to make mistakes, that if I'm going to take a risk, I'm not going to be ridiculed or ostracized for doing that. And that is something that I think a lot of people did not feel at Bridgewater, that, you know, they found a way to share a ton of information, and that maybe it wasn't the most psychologically safe environment for everybody there. And a lot of people left as a result of that. That being said, you know, these are kind of the jobs to be done in a group. Now, to idiosyncrasy credits, the idiosyncrasy credits are really about when can I not go along with the group? When can I be a dissenter and still not get ostracized? Because this is the tricky balance, right? If you disagree mm-hmm. with your group about everything, and you always disagree, you never go along with the crowd, you know, the people aren't going to really see you as part of the group. That's like, well, if you never want to agree with us, if you always are standing in the way of us making the decisions that the rest of us want to make, you know, what are you really doing here? So there's a lot of research on how you can dissent and make a positive difference in your group. And so one of these was idiosyncrasy credits, the idea that I'm going to be a good soldier most of the time, and then I'm going to kind of build up goodwill among the other members. And that's going to give me permission then to dissent, to not go along with the group, to do something that's completely different, to voice an opinion that everyone else disagrees with. And because of the goodwill I've earned over time, I can cash in those credits, those idiosyncrasy credits, to be different than everyone else. Now, I actually would say that's of the two strategies that research has talked about, that's the one I would be slightly, I'd have slightly less confidence in. So it's true that yes, you do have license to dissent the more you've been a good soldier and gone along with the group over time. But if you do that for a long time, you know, so many of us, you know, I think, you know, the kind of revolutionary ideas from the 1960s, you know, we're seeing this play out now where people had all these ideas. We were going to change the institutions. We're going to change society. We're going to change everything just once I work my way up and get into power. But the process of working your way up and getting into power changes you. It changes what we think, and that you understand more why the group is the way it is. You realize that some battles are more important to pick than others, and that, you know, the way you think will be shaped by building up these idiosyncrasy credits over time. And so the other strategy that we see for dissenting is to become what we call a tolerated deviant. And that's more like the Bernie Sanders model, where, you know, he's a Democrat, but he's not really a Democrat, right? He calls himself an independent. So he's in kind of half in, half out of this group that we call the Democratic Party. But that he is very consistent. He has a point of view that differs from the majority view in the group. He voices it consistently over time. You know what he's going to say on this issue all the time. And that then, you know, when the kind of situation changed and the time for those ideas to be more popular came, you know, people believed that he was a good messenger for those ideas. And that strategy of when you disagree with a group, to do that respectfully, to say, you know, hey, I agree with you guys on a lot of stuff, but I really disagree about this, and to be consistent with that over time, and then to build relationships with other people who may be sympathetic to that view. That's actually, I think, a more promising way to get groups to change their mind. That you're going to be consistent with that over time, rather than saying, like, I'm going to swallow my disagreement for a long time, build up those idiosyncrasy credits and wait, versus, no, I'm going to say it, and then I'm just going to kind of bide my time. And if the group, you know, disagrees with me for the time being, I'm still going to try and, you know, build bridges around the other issues that are not this core disagreement.
And Bernie Sanders votes with the Democrats probably over 90% of the time. So you also note that. Exactly. Like, you can't just keep. So I have, this is my life at Second City, is this part. And it's interesting because I think about it in three phases. I remember, so I started here in the 90s, and I had a really good hot streak in terms of starting. First cast was Colbert, Carell, Amy Sedaris. I hired Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. I mean, it's just like, and it wasn't, I got lucky. But you know, it was pretty apparent that in this role I was doing well. And so by the time we got to the 2000s and I was starting to work on new projects and this stuff and getting into slightly more conflict with my boss, I remember one day saying to him, because I had disagreed with something and I spoke up about it, and he got mad at me for doing that. And so privately I went to him, I go, I'm sorry, like, I didn't think you wanted a yes man. Like, if, like, was that, our whole relationship has never been about me being a yes man. Like, I would think you would hate that. And he was, I think he was shamed a little bit into being like, and he said, he goes, you're actually right. I don't want that. I go, okay. Cause I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just like, speak up. And that was a nice little change in the relationship. And then that boss goes away. I have a new boss who I'm seemingly getting along with. And then I discover I'm no longer invited to the leadership meetings. It just fell off my calendar. And I was told like, no, you like, it's, these meetings are boring. They're about numbers. You don't care. And I'm like, I'm pretty good with numbers, but they didn't want conflict with me. I had autonomy. So it didn't kill me, but it was also like, oh. And then new boss I've got now immediately puts me back on the leadership team and we had this great meeting where he said, I've been hearing a lot of analogies that people need to stay in their own lane. I would suggest we're all in this pool together and there are no lanes. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're respectful of other people, we're all in one pool together. Mm-hmm. It became a much sort of healthier atmosphere. But what I have noticed over time, and I'm in this leadership group that's probably been together 5-6 years or so, that still that muscle of disagreeing is very few people flex it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really tough. I mean, it sounds like, I think your new boss is seemingly following what I would think the research would suggest that, you know, especially with a leadership team.
Yep.
What everyone's there is to not just stay in their lane and give the perspective from their functional expertise, but for us to give different perspectives that are not just us speaking on behalf of our function, but putting a whole bunch of brains on the project of what's the strategy for our organization, which is a big, hard problem. And that what you're just describing, a senior leadership team where dissent is no longer the norm, is really all too common. So there's great research by Ruth Wagaman and some of her colleagues at the Hay Group and our former mentor, Richard Hackman, the late, great Richard Hackman, who discovered so many of the things I talk about in the book. And they found that senior leadership teams have this problem almost worse than anybody else, in part because they don't know what they're for. Like senior leadership teams have a very poorly defined task. So it's not like a sport. It's not like putting on a show or a musical ensemble. Like you could do so many different things. You could have so many different goals for how we're going to use our time together, how we're going to use the knowledge and skills of the people in the room. And unless you clarify what that is, it gets really hard to work together. And then the challenge, as you're saying, is just who gets invited to the meetings. And and the task becomes to continue to get invited to the meetings. Mm-hmm. And then actually that phenomenon of trying to get invited to the meeting leads to senior leadership teams really growing in size so that they get too big. And then they get to the point where if you've got 20, 30 people in the room on your senior leadership team,
it's meaningless.
Yeah, you can't have a strategy discussion, right? Like there's no way to even do that. And that you really need to have this smaller size where we can have real conversations. Otherwise, it is, it's a CEO speaking or people delivering reports, and that's all the meetings become. So this kind of idea of like, what are we here for? What is our goal? And having that well defined, and then having a number of people and the right structures in place, again, the composition of the group in a place to achieve that goal is really, really hard. And that I would say, the vast majority of senior leadership teams don't live up to their potential because they don't really ever struggle with these questions.
It's same with boards of directors. Oh,
yeah. Even worse. Yeah.
It is even worse because you're a layer removed, which probably gives you a little less like skin in the game among other reasons. Yeah. But I've sat on so many boards and I don't think I've ever sat on what I would qualify as a functional board of directors.
Yeah. Well, so, unfortunately, a lot of boards are structured intentionally to not be very functional, right? Like it's often not in the CEO's interest to have a really active, purposeful board, and that you have to, it takes a really special leader to put in place, as you say, not having a bunch of yes men to, or yes people to have, the kind of Lincoln's team of rivals idea where I'm going to get a bunch of people who have different ideas and they're going to give a lot of diverse input and advice. And that's what we need. That's what we need to be innovative. That's what we need to learn. And yet it's uncomfortable. We don't, we don't like it. It feels like a nuisance a lot of times when we're in groups that do disagree and have dissenting opinions. And so, this kind of the central thing I think you're bringing up is how do we disagree productively, right? Idiosyncrasy credits, minority influence, all of these are sort of this central question of, we know we need to disagree, right? If we all agree with one another, we're going to have this horrible consensus seeking groupthink and conformity pressures that make groups sometimes very culty and cult-like.
That's right.
And that's not what we want. And yet, disagreement feels really personally threatening to us that our prehistoric brains are petrified that, oh my God, someone disagrees with me, especially someone powerful. They may be about to ostracize me. And so our brain is so afraid of this. And so we really have to kind of take these steps that are going to comfort the prehistoric part of our brain And I think the most comfortable part of comforting thing you can do is kind of what you did, and to say, hey, this is me trying to make us better. This is me mm-hmm. trying to give input on the task, to give different opinions. And that's what I'm here for. That's what we are here for. It's not about you personally, and that's right. really what we're afraid of. And so anytime in a group where you hear it's like, oh, Kelly is the kind of person who that's, if they say anything negative after that, that's a real red flag, right? And that as soon, if I hear any group start to have these kind of personal attributions, you know, they're really already on the path somewhere bad. So I would stop any group right there and say, all right, we need to stay, you know, talk about what's going to make the task better. If we need to take a break, we're going to take a break. But we can't have, you know, people talking about each other as people, and we need to be disagreeing about the task itself, that what we would call task conflict rather than relational or relationship conflict.
Okay, this leads into this leadership section, which I adored. So you went to a talk called Leadership Lessons from Jazz, which one would think you're like all over, like you and I are at this thing, and we're like, yeah man, you know, mm-hmm. but that wasn't your response.
No, that wasn't. And I've changed the names there to protect the innocent a little bit, but, okay, it was, you know, things like listen closely, which is of course a good idea, right?
Sure.
Advice to improvise, which again is advice I would, you know, certainly think is good advice. But it was really vacuous in the sense that it wasn't focusing people on what are the mistakes that people actually make in groups. And that is mostly not about the focus on the self. So advice like find your own sound and things like that gets us really focused on ourselves. But it's also, it said nothing about structure, right? It said nothing about what's the task we're going to do. What are, you know, who's going to be on this team? How do we set goals? Because again, when we take leadership lessons from a lot of these other kinds of, you know, places like jazz, where some of these things are given to us, jazz masters don't need to think about some of those things. And what I objected to was that I think there's so many better lessons to take from jazz than those lessons, right? That like how we do compose groups for diverse inputs in it. So like I use the example in the book of Kind of Blue, of how mm-hmm. Miles Davis chose really different kinds of musicians to be on that album and gave them this really minimal structure, which is something as improvisers we're really familiar with. And then let them do their thing. And that created, you know, what at various times is the best-selling jazz album of all time and the classic, because it has all these different kinds of inputs into it and a structure that let them come together in what I call synergy. And then the other thing that I think it overlooks is it puts the leadership lessons often give too much credit to a single leader, a person. Right. And so this talk, it talked a lot about Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong and Benny Goodman and them as individuals, which, again, there's some great stuff to learn from them. They were all great musicians and leaders in their own right. But the most leadership in group is it has two characteristics. And I would say they're functional and it's shared. Mm-hmm. So by functional, I mean that leadership isn't just the province of whoever's in the formal leader position. That in a good group, everyone provides leadership by achieving the core critical functions of that group, helping to clarify goals, helping to enrich the tasks so that we're doing really enriching good work, that are clarifying the norms, they're creating psychological safety, they're coaching one another so that they're learning and improving their skills from being a part of this group. And all those things should be regarded as leadership, that we're achieving the key functions. We're proactive in trying to help the group achieve these critical functions. And then the other part of that is if that's how we think of leadership, as anything that's helping the group to achieve these critical functions, then that means leadership can be shared. That it's not just the formal leader who gets to do it, it's everyone. And that even asking what might be considered a dumb question, you know, hey, what are we all doing here? You know, what's this meeting for? That can be an act of leadership and a really critical one that anyone does, because it helps clarify the goals. It helps us understand what it is we're here to achieve. And the same goes for asking about norms or questioning norms or to suggesting new ideas for the group to pursue. All these things are the group sharing leadership. And so I think that's really different than saying, hey, let's analyze what Duke Ellington did and try to say that is the only way that we should think about leadership of these kinds of groups.
I mean, I don't know that much about Ellington's, I mean, I know his work, and I imagine because of knowing that work that he was probably a fairly generous leader with regard to the types of players that he had, which is very different from orchestra conductors, which is a thing that you also bring up the book, which I, this is fascinating because like there was a period of time where there was probably a story about a famous conductor in like every business book I was reading. This is like 5 years ago. Yeah. And you take great issue with this.
I know. My wife is an opera singer and she's very nervous about how critical I am of conductors. And I know that, so I know lots of conductors. I went to music conservatory. Most of the conductors I know are great people, amazing musicians. Many of them are really good leaders, but they're stuck in a really archaic organizational form. Mm-hmm. And that's not their fault. But so what I take issue with orchestral conductors is that we, you know, in an orchestra, you have, you know, 60, 70, 80 people who are world leaders, right? They are highly trained. They're some of the best at what they do in these major orchestras. And almost any professional orchestra that survives today in America is a, you know, major orchestra. And those highly trained individuals have almost no say in how to do their own job. And that we put all the responsibility for the artistic direction of the ensemble into this one person. And then, so not only are most orchestras led in such a way that, you know, one person gets the input and then tells everybody else how to do that, but, you know, then we've ended up with a system where people are socialized into that, and that, you know, individual orchestral musicians aren't, you know, trained in such a way that they think it's their role to speak up and to share their views about how we should collectively shape this ensemble. And that, you know, it kind of comes from this older time when a lot of times the composer of the piece was also the conductor in the past. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when, you know, everyone would give all this applause to the conductor coming out, they were often also applauding the composer of the pieces they heard. But now those two things have become almost completely decoupled. Yet,
right,
you know, it's the conductor on the poster. It's the conductor who gets all the applause and all the credit for the collective performance of many, many people who've input a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears into becoming able to realize this music. And that using that as a model for other forms of organizing is just a real waste of talent. And it shows actually in the data. So Richard Hackman, again, did a great study of the satisfaction of different kinds of groups with their membership of those groups. And one of them were orchestral musicians. And I think they looked at 13 different professions. And orchestral musicians, which you think would be a really fun thing to do, to play music as your job, they came in seventh. Mm. And I believe they were just ahead of clerical workers and just behind federal prison guards, as I recall. And it's not that classical music makes you inherently dissatisfied or that we're selecting, you know, people who were unhappy with their jobs into classical music, string quartets were the most satisfied. So these smaller ensembles,
small groups
where people had a lot of say into how to do their jobs, because, you know, string quartets do not have conductors.
Nope.
Everyone gets some say into how we're going to play the music. They were really happy. And so when we think about how do we want to structure our groups, we want to structure them more like string quartets, more like jazz ensembles, more like, you know, these small groups, you know, theater groups that are 5-6 people who have a, you know, like a comedy team or something, where they're doing improv. Those kind of groups are the kinds we should aspire to, not having one person conducting, you know, dozens or scores of other people and having them realize that one vision.
So I talked about this in Yes And, our partnership with Lyric Opera Chicago and Renee Fleming. So, you know, part of the thing that we did that was so smart with that was when Renee sort of proposed that we do something together, I just had the instinct that we needed time to build language and understand, because my hunch was we were going to be very different. And I mean, you couldn't get more different than an improv theater and an opera company. But in that year, and it was a year of like leading people through improv workshops, and my wife taught all the people in their conservatory, and they were like, this is like therapy to us. You have no idea. Like, all we're told is, if we're told where to stand, and this is the other thing we learned about directors of opera, sometimes they even tell the people who are in minor parts where to go. But if we're told where to stand, the only thing that we get, the only note is if we're doing something wrong. We're just not even, you know, spoken to it. I'm like, that is terrible. That is terrible leadership. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're able to do, you know, world-class work because they, of course, have the score and they have skill, but also, like, you know, these institutions are in trouble because they've been working from these deficits and endowments, and those endowments are going to, you know, they will go away at some point, you know, and we're already seeing that. And the concept that this strikes with our work is the concept of follow the follower, which is truly this idea of, you know, we're trading off leadership at any given time. And understanding our director's job, the director is in charge of the ensemble, but really their job is to make sure that the ensemble is working to the top of its ability. So that's everything. Like, I know when my wife teaches this stuff, it's like, she's like, one of the most important things is that everyone understands their schedule for the day. And if they can understand what their schedule is for the day, you're going to avoid a lot of problems, because that once you get out of that. And so this is everything you're saying. It's not a denial that our improv stuff is really powerful and useful, but it is meaningless if you don't have the other thing, the structure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and the improvisation is a big part of my research as well. It's not just the personal passion, but that in trying to study improvisation in organizations, I kept bumping into this problem where there were so many first order issues with the way they were organizing their groups and teams, that it was like, oh, you know, I want to talk about how to improvise better, but we don't know the goals that we're supposed to be achieving. We want to improvise better, but in some cases, like on these senior leadership teams, they don't even know who's on the team with them. So that in the Ruth Wagaman study, they asked, you know, how many people are on your team? Only 7% of senior leadership teams gave identical answers to how many people were on the team. 93% of them disagreed on how many people were even there. And how are you supposed to collaborate if you don't know who you're supposed to collaborate with? And so, you know, these kinds of, so the reason that, you know, this book is in some ways about the basics of group dynamics, and it's not diving into all the intricacies of improvising, although that may be the next book, but is because I think these are the things that I've found people need, that the most organizations need to think about the structure of their team. They need to think about the tasks that they're doing. They need to understand what productive norms, where we can disagree productively, look like. And some of that you can get through improv and improvisation, you know, norms about speaking up, about sharing your ideas, about listening to other people, about adjusting. you can obviously get those, and those are really important. But that, as you say, if you don't even know who you're working with or what you're supposed to be achieving, mm-hmm. that doesn't do you that much good.
No. And you point this out in the book too. One of the difficulties around some of the academic, some of the literature around groups is they're not studying. It's very hard to study a successful group. So let's use Second City, for example, mm-hmm. you know, which is, it's a cast of six. Usually mm-hmm. there's a new person that comes in every year to that group of six, right? And they're together all the time, and they're doing this work in front of audiences. And that is so much harder than to study than like these brainstorming studies where they bring mm-hmm. in people who don't know each other. It's like, all right, that's apples and oranges. I used to get in this fight with Nick Epley all the time because he's like, brainstorming is not a thing. And I'm like, well, I get what you're saying, but of course it's a thing in terms of how would we be able to do what we do so yeah. successfully. So I don't know how we solve that problem. I mean, you've probably looked into this more than most in terms of how you study those yeah. kinds of groups.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to write something about that whole brainstorming thing because it's pervasive in the groups literature yeah. that, you know, if you ask social psychologists, they'll tell you, you know, brainstorming groups is really inefficient. You should just have individuals go off and do it on their own and aggregate them. But that really, you know, there's great research on the design firm IDEO, which I write about yep. in the book quite a bit by Andrew Hargadon and Bob Sutton. And they looked at IDEO's practice of brainstorming. And this comes back to, again, what's the goal? They found that, like, yeah, you know, did the only goal of coming together and brainstorming that way wasn't to maximize the quantity of ideas or necessarily, right? Like, it was to build a certain kind of culture. It was to make sure people knew each other and what their different expertises were. It was sometimes to involve clients in a creative way that they couldn't do through other means. And so the measures that we have in the social psychology literature for looking at the output of these groups may not have fully captured what all the goals were. And that said, you know, I have tons of thoughts about, you know, if you are going to do brainstorming in an organization that's not used to it, that doesn't have really productive norms for how you do it, then there are different things you can do to kind of minimize what we call process losses, right? That, like,
yeah,
there are some things that are absolutely lost when, especially groups that don't know how to brainstorm together, start trying to do it. That they make very predictable mistakes, and that's really what that literature is picking up on, is saying, like, yeah, if you bring a group of strangers together who don't know how to brainstorm, and you ask them to brainstorm, they're going to do worse as a group than they would have if you just split them up and had them as individuals. But I think the laboratory is great for establishing causality, right? The mm-hmm. laboratory—that's what laboratory experiments are really good at. They're also good at finding being controlled environments where we can isolate very tiny aspects of group dynamics, and that lets us understand, you know, things like, oh, actually, you know, doing these trust falls before we get together as a group isn't going to be very effective. It lets us isolate the sort of chain of cause and effect. But it's the real world is so much messier, and that groups inherently are filled with these contradictions of not just one goal, but multiple goals. And that if you ask every individual their individual goals, some of those will be really consonant with the group's overall goal, and some of them will be slightly at odds from the group goal. And so defining, you know, the sort of success and tracing a group towards these different outcomes is really tough, because you do have to look both at what's the group supposed to be there doing, who are the clients of the group's work, are they, you know, and is the group achieving those aims, but also, is this good for the human beings involved, and are they made better by their participation in these groups? And that's really tricky. And that, you know, because groups are these open systems, right? They're not mm-hmm. that we are changing as a result of being part of these groups over time. So, if, you know, your Second City teams are there, even, you know, a year, is a long time in our lives, right? And that we are different. Our skills are different, that you can't just trace the inputs of that person when they walked in the door and then predict what's going to happen, because the person's going to change by being a member of that group. And that's what makes group dynamics, you know, so important and so fascinating for us, that they, you know, groups are the crucibles in which we are shaped as individuals. So, you know, what you are, what you think is important, how happy you are in your life, all these things are really shaped by the groups of which you're a member.
Colin, have you looked at Caroline Fleck's validation book? Do you know about this?
I have not, but I heard you mention it in another podcast episode.
I'm a little obsessed by your book and her book. But one of the things that she has is she references some literature that talks about the one personal aspect trait that sort of crossed over in successful groups was social sensitivity. That someone inside that group had this. And this is like what my wife Ann, I think, has referred to this at Second City, as you know that your group ensemble success is dependent on who your alpha is, and that's not necessarily like the person who's been there the longest. It's the one person everyone listens to. And so my adaptation reading this in Caroline's book was also like oh, but that's what that person has, is a level of social sensitivity to understand what the group dynamics are, to make sure everyone is being minimally taken care of to be able to keep going forward. And very hard probably to measure in certain situations, but strikes me as true.
Yeah, I mean, social sensitivity, this is work by Anita Woolley and Christopher and some of their colleagues. And it showed that, you know, what they call collective intelligence. So the ability of a group to perform not just one task, but across a variety of different kinds of tasks, was not predicted very well by individual intelligence or the average intelligence or the maximum intelligence on the group. It wasn't predicted by other aspects of personality like extroversion or introversion or the mix of introverts and extroverts. Those things tend not to be great predictors of collective performance. But that the average level of social sensitivity, which is our ability to intuit the feelings of others without being told, and that it's actually, of the things we have, it's fairly easy to measure relative to other other things we have.
Yeah.
So there's it's not perfect, but there's a fun test called the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, where it shows you these pictures just of somebody's eyes. And there's like, you have four options for how that person reported feeling when the picture was taken, and essentially someone's score on that test, the amount of times you get right what that person reported feeling just from a picture of their eyes, is what we use as our measure of social sensitivity. And that, you know, so it's not the maximum level in the sense that you have to have one person who's really good at it, but the average level was what they found predicted. And that just gets at the idea that in a group, we need a shared understanding of not just, you know, how we're doing on the task. You know, we want to have tasks where we can see how well we're progressing, but that also how people are feeling about that. Are we excited? Are we starting to have this lull? And I think some people find this idea, because social sensitivity, it is something you can get better at, it, and it's certainly something that you can improve. But it is largely a trait that, you know, most people are, you know, if you're really, really low in it, you're probably not going to ever be really, really high, and vice versa. But that luckily there's a way you can compensate if you don't feel like you're somebody who's especially social or sensitive. And it's by asking questions, that if you don't know how other people are feeling, you can ask. And that can be just as much of being a leader who's helping the group and to really understand one another as somebody who can do it without asking. So I think not being discouraged by this finding, and also not overweighting it in selection decisions. So it's definitely true that of the things we can measure in groups, that social sensitivity is the one thing where the average level helps. So if you pick members who have more of that, then you're better off. But as we were talking about earlier, it's a common problem that we choose totally the wrong number of people for the team.
Yeah.
It's a common problem that we choose the people who are on teams for political reasons rather mm-hmm. than for the knowledge and skills that they bring to the task. And so the first order things are, you know, get the number of people you should have on the team right. Get select for the knowledge and skills that you need for that task. And then social sensitivity is great. And I think, you know, if you have a good sense of that, it's great to have a member or two that have that. But that it's not something that's the difference between a group, you know, succeeding and failing on average. That, you know, we talk in terms of effect sizes in research. And this is something that we would say, you know, controls less than 10% of the variance in team outcomes. So this is not like a factor that's 50, 60, 70% of your team performance. It's much less than that. And it's more like taking ibuprofen for pain. It's like, it's right. A good thing to do, but it usually if you have any kind of serious pain, it's not going to take it away entirely. So it's good advice, but I think a lot of people really latch on to this aspect of team composition, but then keep ignoring how many people are on the team. Did you get people with the right mix of knowledge and skills? And I think those are the more important factors.
I could talk to you all day, but we're going to have to wrap up. And so for returning guests, we ask if they've got a thank you because story for us.
Thank you because story. So yeah, I thought about this when you sent this to me mm-hmm. and I have a story that it's one of those where I'm not positive I should be telling it in public, but I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah. When I was in graduate school, I was part of a competition for like best dissertation. And that's already probably not a great thing to have, right? We don't want to have like competitions between scholars for the best dissertation. I would sort of rather have a world where we're not competing with each other on that. But I went into that, and in retrospect, I did a really terrible job. I thought of it kind of as a competition in my head, and I was trying to show off and be, you know, this really flashy, good presenter who, you know, in the world of academia, believe it or not, you know, I'm a reasonably polished presenter. I was a performer before, so I'm not too nervous up in front of a crowd. And I thought it went really well. And then I was sitting across from one of the judges at dinner, and she told me, just spent the whole dinner telling me all the reasons that my approach to it had been bad and wrong. Mm. And I was just in shock. You know, I was a PhD student and I was about to go on the job market. And I was like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And I really, like, I wasn't taking in what she was saying. I was just kind of in so much shock that that was what was happening at this supposedly like big honor place to be. And, you know, I would tell this story to friends and people I was close to in the field. And one day, the same woman came up to me and said, "Hey, I hear you telling everybody that I hate you." Hmm. And I'm like, "Oh my God, no, I'm not, but I probably was." In fact, okay. Telling people that. and we ended up having a heart to heart where she was really explaining to me how, you know, she was really trying to help me. And I think I was just so much in shock from the initial idea of I was in this situation where I was expecting it to be this kind of celebratory thing to be a part of. And then I was getting like real honest feedback and I didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, we had this conversation actually outside of a jazz performance that was going on that we were supposed to both go into. And we both cried and hugged and ended up really having, you know, a great relationship now. And I really am grateful to her now, because it really has changed my perspective on both what I'm going to do with that kind of feedback when I get it, but two, what a small world this is, that, you know, you can't be assuming other people's intentions, much less gossiping about them and talking about them in these kind of small worlds. So my thank you because goes out to an unnamed judge, but you know who you are if you're hearing this story, who gave me feedback as a PhD student and then had the courage to come up and follow that up and have a really meaningful conversation about what that meant.
Oh, I'm so glad you shared that story. That's great. The book is called The Collective Edge, Unlocking the Secret Power of Groups. Colin Fisher, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It was a pleasure.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.